We are studying the book of Genesis. I'm on page 117 in Genesis 24. We've been talking about the fact that Isaac's mother died. Abraham's wife died. Isaac's mother. And Isaac has been cared for pretty much hand and foot by his mama these 40 years. And his father realizes that he needs somebody to care for him. And so he sends Eleazar Damascus, his chief steward, his in some ways best friend. He's been with him for many, many years. He sends Eleazar of Damascus back to the people of Abraham and that they came from and where Sarah came from, back to the people who were his family, to find a wife or a bride for Isaac, because he doesn't want Isaac to marry among the infidels when they're living. Ishmael had done that and proved to be very difficult for the family. Eleazar of Damascus goes back and he prays to the God of Abraham that God will make his way successful. And he gets to the general area where they lived, or the Chaldees, and he comes to a well and he asks God that he would reveal to him who the young maiden is that he should seek. He wants somebody to be Abraham's family. He wants God to provide a young maiden of worth, nobility, for the sake of his master. He's a good steward for his master's son. And so he sort of fleeces the Lord to say, "Lord, if someone comes up to me, one of these young ladies here at the well, and says, let me give you a drink of water," and he said, "That'll be a good sign. But if he says, let me also feed your water your camels for you, that'd be a really good sign. So we'll just trust that that's the way you'll reveal to us who this woman is." And sure enough, out comes this young lady, and she does those things. And he asks her where she's from, who she relates to, and it turns out she is Isaac, because she's Abraham's brother's near kin. She's granddaughter of his Abraham's brother. And so Eleazar is excited about that. So he winds up going back and having dinner with these folks and telling them that Abraham has become very prosperous and that he has a son, Isaac. He's going to inherit everything, and that Isaac's looking for a bride. And he's asking this family if they would release this young lady, Rebecca, to go with him to be Isaac's bride. And he's loaded to the gills with gifts and money and possessions and presents and whatever, because after all, he needs a bride price. And in the culture of the day, what's happening is a normal exchange with, you know, how can I use my daughter here to better the tribe and, you know, the exchange and all that sort of thing. And so there's this whole conversation that goes on, and it's decided that Rebecca has decided she wants to take this on. Think about it, she's never met this person. She's never met the person's father. She's never met any of them. But she sees it as a pretty good deal. If you're a young lady in this particular time frame, you know that somewhere along the line you're going to get married off to somebody, and it could be, a peasant with an IQ of 10, or it could be somebody with some substance or whatever. And this looks like a pretty good deal to her, and so she quickly agrees to this. Laban, her brother, who's sort of running things because the father's older, tries to get this guy to stay a long time, and he wants to see what he can extract from the guy. And Eleazar is smarter than all that, and he says, "I need to go back in the morning, and I need to take Rebecca with me. That's the deal." And so Laban asks Rebecca if she's willing to go with the guy the next morning, and drops all subterfuge, really. And she says, "Yep, I'm out of here." And so what happens is she's agreed to take this months of camel ride across the desert with a man she doesn't know in order to meet and marry someone she doesn't know, whose father is a sort of a family legend, but she's never met. And so it is. Then the next morning, Rebecca, verse 24, 61, chapter 4, rose with her maids, and they mounted the camels and followed the man. So the servant took Rebecca and departed, it's Eleazar. Now Isaac had come from going to Beer Lahai-Roi, for he was living in the Negev. And Isaac went out to meditate in the field toward evening, and he looked up, and behold, camels were coming. And Rebecca lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from the camel. She said to the servant, that's Eleazar, "Who is the man walking in the field to meet us?" And the servant said, "He is my master." So then she took her veil, covered herself. The servant told Isaac the things that had happened, and Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. And thus Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Isaac married Rebekah by taking her to his tent. In the Bible, consummation is marriage. If you are single and you have sex with someone, you're legally married in the eyes of the community and God and whatever. So in effect, the penalty for fornication is marriage in this particular culture. The penalty for adultery is stoning, so marriage is... Even in 1 Corinthians 6, down at the bottom of the page, Paul is telling the Corinthians that they shouldn't be going to the temple to have sexual worship with the temple prostitutes. That is not a Christian thing to do, although it's a mainstay of the religion they came from. And he's trying to explain it to these Gentiles. He said, "Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ, that we belong to God, and particularly to Christ? Shall I then take away the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? Should I join myself to a harlot and thereby join Jesus to that harlot? May it never be. Or do you not know that one who joins himself to a harlot is one body with her? For he says, the two shall become flesh. Marriage is defined at the very beginning as the two shall become one flesh. But the one who joins himself to the Lord is one spirit with him." So even in Paul's day, this was understood to be so. And even forward into the ages, Middle Ages, etc., this was understood to be so. All right, Rebekah's wedding was a kind of elope-in-place affair. As soon as he laid eyes on her, Isaac took her to his tent. In the Bible, sexual consummation is legally a promise to marry. For Isaac, Rebekah is a replacement for Sarah. She continues Sarah's comforting nurturance of Isaac and continues leading him around by the nose, just like his mama did. Sad but true, it happens too often. Mothers, be careful what you train into your children. Fathers, we are particularly responsible for what our sons become. In the absence of masculine input, they will develop feminized souls. Feminized souls are wonderful for women, but not for men. Unless you're going to have one of these gender confirmation things, you know. Now, Abraham took another wife, whose name was Keturah. Before I go over here, anybody want to talk about Isaac's wedding or anything? It's a lot of cultural. But... Okay.
I've forgotten when Isaac's mother died.
Well, Isaac's 40 years old. Isaac's 40 years old when his mother dies. Sarah dies when Isaac's 40 years old. What else did you want to know, huh? Well, it's because she dies that they send off to get him a bride.
Oh.
Yeah, just because they needed somebody to take care of him. He's not like Ishmael. He's a bit of a mama's boy.
Was it normal for people to wait until they were 40 to get married back in that day?
Well, I don't know that was true.
Back in that day, huh? Not a lot of people made it to 40 in those days.
Back in those days, they lived to 110 to 175.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Abraham dies at 175. Isaac lives to be about 121 or something like that.
A lot of people would have had some sort of ceremony about getting married.
They might have had a... Remember that even in Jesus' day, the wedding feast took place a year after the engagement. And once the engagement occurred, sexual activity was permissible to the young couple because an engagement was final. In the culture of Jesus' day, which goes on beyond that, you have a young girl who's maybe 12. There is a prearranged marriage, maybe when they were born or six or whatever. And at age 12, she's married off to someone. It may be someone who's 4 to 5 years older than her or someone who's 40 to 45 years older than her, depending on circumstances. If you remember Fiddler on the Roof, and remember you can't be a Christian if you haven't seen Fiddler on the Roof. Zidel, the oldest daughter of Tevye, is betrothed to Laser Wolf the Butcher.
He's like 50 or 60.
No, he's 65.
Right.
Yeah, and she's 19.
Right.
In fact, when Laser Wolf and Tevye go celebrate the engagement at the bar, which they celebrate quite heavily.
He hadn't told his daughter yet.
Yeah, no, of course not. Well, because actually, the matchmaker made the arrangement with Golde, and he had to go work it out. But at any rate, Tevye and Laser Wolf had the conversation, and Tevye realizes that Laser Wolf, he's now Papa to Laser Wolf, who is older than him.
Right.
So anyway, a little bit of vino, and it's okay. But yeah, all right.
Wayne,
yes.
I don't think the Bible addresses this, but in my modern brain, I would think that Isaac might have a few hang-ups because of his near-death experience with his father.
There's not a single indication that bothered him at all.
I know that.
Yep.
That's it. The Bible doesn't. I just have to think that might be part of the story.
I think what you're doing is you're reading 21st century culture into...
my modern brain.
Yeah. See, I don't. First of all, they don't have the same expectations, sense of entitlement, and all manner of other things. And remember that child sacrifice is not uncommon. So the fact that, when God tells Abraham to go sacrifice his son, Abraham doesn't fuss about the fact that there's something immoral going on with sacrificing his son. Now he probably pleaded with God a great deal to think of another task, but there's no indication. I mean, he's not challenging on the basis of it's morally right or wrong, because it's culturally done everywhere. So we have to remember that even like our wedding and marriage culture is cultural, and does not even apply in this day and age in other places. When we went to Swaziland, we met a lot of Christians who were polygamous. They were born-again people, and they were polygamous because they come out of polygamous cultures, and they were only beginning to start thinking about whether they should put away their extra wives, and most of them didn't. But so what happened is you have these arranged marriages, and once the engagement was made and it was sealed with the exchange of a bride price in exchange for the engagement, then what happened is that the young couple began to get to know each other. Typically, she would stay at her parents' house during the engagement period, usually a year, and he would come and visit, but they had conjugal rights, and if he was at all sensitive, he would take some time for her to kind of get to know him. He's 12 years old, she's something, you know. I mean, she understands technically what all is supposed to happen because they raise sheep, but that's not exactly the same. You know? If he's a beast, then... you know, the engagement gets consummated in about 10 minutes, but ultimately what happens is at some point there's this consummation. The biblical rules are that when the first consummation occurs, it's supposed to happen in her father's house on clean sheets. And when it occurs, it's supposed to leave, it will leave hymeneal blood on the sheets. Those are called in the Bible the tokens of her virginity. And so this first consummation is supposed to occur like this, and the parents then have the tokens of her virginity. So if it's later alleged that she wasn't a virgin, they can bring this as evidence to the case. And the Bible speaks about this in the Old Testament, the tokens of her virginity. If you saw the movie Yentl, you know, because I think God gives us movies so we understand things. You remember that Yentl was the daughter of a rabbi who, upon the death of her rabbi father, went to rabbinical school dressed as a boy. And she faked being a boy because she wanted to go to school, which was not open to her as a woman. She was quite knowledgeable because her father had taught her a lot of things. But she faked being a boy. So she goes to rabbinical school, and she and Mandy Patinkin, he becomes her kind of tutor. And he begins to develop a whole lot of feelings for her, which are confusing to him because she's supposed to be a boy. So what happens is that the village elder hears about what a bright student this boy is, and he invites him over to meet his daughter, the lovely, what's all the curls, what's her name?
Amy Irving.
Amy Irving, yeah. And Amy Irving is this quintessential young Jewish girl. She's been trained to cook and bake and care for her husband and look beautiful and be available upon request. I mean, she's just going to be the excellent wife. And so Yentl's in a pickle because she's being sort of forced into an engagement process here, which she puts off for as long as she can until finally they're forced to be married. So now they're having the whole hoopah and all that sort of thing. She's going, oy vey, you know. And so come the wedding night, Yentl, the boy, says, you know, we don't need to rush into this. I need to be sensitive to how you feel about all of this. And Amy Irving's going, what's to be sensitive about, you know, but okay. And so they said, but the mother and dad will be expecting the tokens of my virginity in the morning. And so Yentl takes a glass of wine and just kind of pours that out over the sheets. That's supposed to get the job done. Well, that goes on for a while, and you can only pull this off for so long. And then it comes out that she's not a boy after all, but a girl, and all kinds of problems emerge. You know, first of all, she got married to a girl. That's a problem. The wealthy man whose daughter has been, you know, defrauded or whatever, that's a problem. Amy Irving has some problems with the thing. And Mandy Patinkin's really in a fix because he's been fighting his lust for this boy only to find out that it's this girl. And then, of course, there's the issues at school with the fact that they have been educating a girl for the last couple of years in their school, which blows everything through the roof. And there's only one thing for Yentl to do, and that's get on a ship and go to America. That's all she can do. But in that whole process, the biblical culture of marriage and the tokens and all that sort of thing are shown so this purposes. So when Mary of Nazareth shows up pregnant, coming back from visiting Elizabeth, everyone assumes it's Joseph's baby. Otherwise, she'd been stoned. And Joseph knows it's not his baby, but we're told very clearly that he decided not to put her, not to expose her, because he cared for her, but to wait and put her away privately later, divorce her later. And then, of course, an angel comes and tells him what Mary could have tried to tell him. You know, I'm impregnated by God. So, I think that one's probably been used once or twice already. Anyway, so that has to do with Rebecca and Isaac and them coming together. And remember that marriage was an institution that was designed for the benefit of the family, for the ongoing of the race, and it was more businesslike than romantic. Although some people actually had romance. For instance, Jacob and Rachel have romance. Jacob and Leah have a business partnership going, and as well as the other two, you know. So. Romance was not the main thing. We had romances are sort of a, it happened sometimes. Sometimes later it happened. Goldie, do you love me? Do I love you? You know, she's going, you're crazy, you're nuts. What's the problem? Do I love you? What does that mean? And he says, well, just do you love me? And she said, 25 years I've washed his clothes, cooked his food, shared his bed, you know.
Had four daughters.
Yeah, had four daughters. If that's not love, what is, you know? Well, but Goldie, do you love me? Well, I guess maybe I do. And he says, nothing really changes with that revelation, but it's nice to know. So this is a cultural business proposition of some importance. And so here that's Rebecca and Isaac and their betrothal, engagement, elopement, marriage, fresh off the back of a camel. Okay, anybody else want to? All right.
We're all too frightened to ask.
What'd you say?
We're going to get Titanic next.
Titanic. Yeah. Well. Yeah, we talked about the Titanic. The lovers on the Titanic were the old people in bed.
No, I wasn't suggesting.
You brought it up.
I only know four things, and I just look for opportunities to teach them. Okay? All right. Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. So after Sarah dies, and of course Hagar's moved on down the road.
Abraham's 140 years old now, right? He's 140 now, right?
Abraham's 140 years old. Okay. So he took another wife whose name is Keturah. And she bore to him Zimram, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua.
He was older than that. Sarah was 140.
Abraham was 100 years... He was
130.
Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac was born, and Isaac is 40.
Oh, okay.
Sarah was 89 when Isaac was born. You all have heard this before, I'm sure, but Nancy was talking to Esther Mulley some time ago when they were staying with us, and she was talking about her mother, and she said, Esther, how was your mother? And she said, well, let's see, my grandmother. Your grandmother's still alive? Her grandmother was 113. And in Africa, there are a lot of centenarians because they don't sugar and a lot of other things that we eat. Now, they don't have cavities because they don't eat sugar, but they have gingivitis because they don't brush. But they walk everywhere, and they eat basic foods, you know, vegetables and stuff like that. They don't have a lot of meat and whatever, and they haven't seen
foods.
They haven't seen a piece of KFC their whole lifetime.
No.
Alrighty. So we have this kid, and Jokshan became the father of Sheba and Dedan. Sons of Dedan were Asherim, Letushim, and Lebumim. Sons of Midian were Ephah and Epher and Hanok and Abida and Eldah. All these were the sons of Keturah. Now Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac. But to the sons of the concubines, Abraham gave gifts while he was still living and sent them away from his son Isaac eastward to the land of the east. And these are all the years of Abraham's life that he lived, 175 years. Abraham breathed his last and died a ripe old age, an old man and satisfied with life. And he was gathered to his people, which is actually a reference to going to Sheol. Gathered his people. Then his sons Isaac and Ishmael, who have no enmity whatsoever between them. They've been good friends all along. The mothers didn't like each other much, but Isaac and Ishmael were fine. It wasn't until the followers later began to scrap that they had that problem. So Isaac and Ishmael, they bury their father in the cave of Machpelah in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar, the Hittite facing Mamre. The field which Abraham purchased from the sons of Heth. And there Abraham was buried with Sarah, his wife. Came about after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac lived in Beer Lahai Roy. So, I guess Abraham's virility question has been answered. He marries Keturah, has six quick sons, and when they get to be adults, he gives them their inheritance and sends them away. Absolutely what would be expected in the culture. All the way up until the time of Downton Abbey, and somewhat beyond that, you had the issue of protecting the estate by turning it over to an adopted or firstborn son, sometimes the firstborn, but a specified or adopted son who was responsible for it and the village and everything around it, and who became the lord of the manor. And then any other sons that you might have had to be dealt with elsewhere. If you were a person who had wealth and you were nobility, whatever, what you wanted was an heir and a spare. Because if the heir were to die, you would need a spare. So, for instance, you have Edward VIII, but since he runs off with Wallace Simpson, then the spare, George, has to step in and take care of that. So it's important to have an heir and a spare. George would have had a fairly nice, easygoing, ceremonial life and never had to deal with the stuttering if it hadn't been for the fact that he was forced into being king. If you were a fan of Jane Austen, you know that Colonel Fitzwilliams is Darby's cousin, and he is the second-born son of his father. He's the spare. And because his brother inherits everything, Colonel Fitzwilliams has been sent into the army probably when he was about 12 so that he could take a place of rank and grow up, and that was his career. He was a military guy, and then he would retire from that with sort of a pension. But he didn't have much except Darby, his cousin, was kind to him and kept him in the style to which he wished he could become acquainted. So Darby was a friend, and he took him all over the place with him. And also the Lady Catherine de Bourgh, which was his aunt, had promised, was likely to leave him a wad when she died, which is why you have the quadrennial visits up there of Darby and Fitzwilliams and all that sort of thing. That's the culture. That's the culture then. It's culture now. That's culture back here in the time we're talking about. Abraham has taken, or had taken, Hebrew meaning another concubine. After Sarah's death, Keturah becomes positionally Abraham's wife. She bore her children after Isaac. She bore her children after Isaac was born. So they were no threat politically, as long as we can keep them out of the, send them away. Sarah has only one child, Isaac. Hagar has only one son, Ishmael, before she also was sent away with money. We read about that story earlier on. Keturah has many sons, but she is treated as a concubine in the story. One of her sons, Midian, is famous, and we get this little short toledot there at the beginning about who Abraham's sons were and who their sons were, because some of them are going to be needed in the story later. And one of those is Midian. Midian, the Midianite peoples were followers of Abraham's God well down the road from there. I mean, many of Abraham's descendants wandered away from God. But the Midianites were faithful to God, so that in the day of Moses, which is some 500 years later, when Moses has fled Egypt in order to get away from Pharaoh, he finds himself in the land of Midian at the foot of Sinai. And there he encounters Jethro, priest of Midian, who has seven daughters and marries the oldest daughter, Zipporah. He goes to work for Jethro, his father-in-law, as a shepherd. If you have seven daughters, it's nice to find some sons, because you need that. He goes to work for Jethro, and there at the foot of the mountain, he learns about the God of Abraham from Jethro, the priest of Midian. One of the things that he learned is that God dwells on this mountain, and from time to time he manifests himself with fire and whatever. And some years after having come there, about 40 years later, he sees up on the mountain a bush that's on fire but never stops burning. And it confuses him, and so he goes up on the mountain to see what that phenomenon's about. And it's there that God meets him and says, I want you to go back to Egypt and set my people free. You know, this is the story. But it's this son Midian and his descendants that actually teach Moses about the God of Abraham, because he didn't learn that in Pharaoh's house. He knew nothing about all of that until he learns it from the priest of Midian, Jethro. Jethro shows up later in the story, because Moses, like a lot of men, gets so busy with their job they lose their family. Keturah takes her two sons and goes home when Moses is up and running up and down the mountain doing stuff. Hasn't got time to be a good father. So she goes home with her two sons. And after a while, Jethro's had enough of being grandpa, and so he brings the wife and the two sons back to Moses and says, here's your family, you need to do something about this.
When do you mean Zipporah?
Zipporah, what'd I say?
Keturah.
I mean Zipporah. I'm sorry, Moses' wife, Zipporah. Thank you. So what happens is that Jethro stays and watches what's going on, trying to figure out this whole family thing that's whatever. And after a while, he says to Moses, you know, you're not a very smart man for somebody who, you know, God's using, because you're trying to do everything yourself. Everything that comes up, you try to manage it. It's no wonder you don't have time to be a father to your children or a husband to your wife. So here's what you should do. You should appoint men over tens, men over hundreds, men over thousands. And you should create this hierarchical structure and let them make the decisions about what needs to be done. And when the things are too hard for them, let them trickle on up to you and you just handle those. And God said, that's right, Abraham. That's what you should be doing. And so Abraham gets a life. And now Moses gets a life. And, you know, the problem with hanging around people who are demented is that you...
It wears off.
Compliment, but at least I know a good home I can go to. That'll be a lot of fun. We get the story of Jethro, even in this story, much later in the deal. Jethro, whose name was also Reuel, we're told, and Hobab, that was another one of his names. Hobab, I recommend that for your next grandchild, I think. That's a good one. Isaac gets the lion's share of Abraham's blessings and possessions. Protection of royal or wealth-based lineage is strategically important in every age. Sending away Ishmael, the son of a concubine, ends his threat. And sending away Keturah's offspring ends their threat. Everyone would have understood and approved of this disposition of wealth to the sons of a concubine. This was commonly done everywhere until recent times. And then I went through the whole thing about Jane Austen fans and everything. I did that. Okay, as God has directed, Isaac is the son of the promise, and he and his seed or descendants receive the blessing. He and his seed get the promised land. He and his seed are the covenant bearers. They are the chosen people with great responsibilities as well. Now, we see, for instance, today in the struggle in the Middle East that they're all claiming to be, they are, the sons of Abraham. But the promise has come down through Isaac at the expense of both the descendants of Ishmael and the descendants of Esau. Abraham lives to a ripe old age. He is 140 when old Isaac is married. He is 160 years old when Jacob and Esau are born. The twins were 15 when Abraham died. Abraham was happy and satisfied in his old age, and like Isaac was, and like Jacob was not. We'll get to the contrast between Isaac, Jacob, and Abraham in that regard as we go on. Jacob's ethics and his choices set him up for unhappiness. Abraham and Isaac were more open and honest than Jacob. Jacob paid the price for his deceptive practices by many unhappy years, especially as he aged. In Genesis 47, which is the third last chapter of Genesis, Jacob has come to meet Pharaoh because his son Joseph has found him and brought him to meet Pharaoh. And Jacob tells Pharaoh, "The years of my journey, my sojourning, are 130. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my father lived during the days of his sojourning." His testimony at the end of his life is, "I've had a tough life." What we're going to see is it's all very self-imposed. But he said, not like my father, who lived happily during the years of his life. Abraham was gathered to his people and then was buried. Gathered his people refers to his soul going to Sheol. Buried at Machpelah refers to what happened only to his physical body. From the beginning, the Bible teaches a tripart existence. Even Aristotle taught body, soul, and spirit long before all of this. The body teaches a tripart existence, body, soul, and spirit. I'm not going to get into all the Sheol stuff here because I've covered it a million times. And there's an appendix that you can go to if you want to read more about that. In Ecclesiastes, it says concerning a man's death, it said, "A man goes to his eternal home while the mourners go about the street. Remember him before the silver cord is broken, the golden bowl is crushed, the pitcher by the well is shattered, the wheel of the cistern is crushed. And then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it." Solomon says, when a man dies, the connection between his soul and his spirit and his body is snapped. The body goes to dust, the soul goes to Sheol, and the spirit returns unto God who gave it, waiting for the resurrection. Isaac and Ishmael are together at the burial of Abraham. There's no sign anywhere of animosity between Isaac and Ishmael themselves. The animosity that developed between their descendants later was nowhere in evidence in their own lives. They celebrated a common father whom they both loved and who loved them both. Isaac moves to Ishmael's birthplace, Beer Lahai Roy, as the new family residence. So when Abraham dies, Isaac moves to the land of Ishmael, his older brother, whom he loves. Ishmael has made a way for Isaac, probably in deference to Abraham. Muslims and Arabs consider themselves descended from Abraham through Ishmael. This lack of strife would have greatly contributed to Abraham's happy old age. Told Abraham was happy and whatever, it's because his sons were not fighting each other. In Genesis 25:12. Now these are the records of the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maid, bore to Abraham. These are the names of the son of Ishmael by their names in the order of their birth. Nebaioth, the firstborn of Ishmael, Kedar, and Ibeel, and Mibsam, Mishnah, Duma, and Masa, Hadad, and Tema, Jetur, Nafish, and Kadama. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their villages, by their camps, 12 princes according to their tribes. So God promised Abraham he would make 12 tribes of Ishmael in the same way he made 12 tribes of Isaac. That he would bless Ishmael like he blessed Isaac, although Ishmael wouldn't be the firstborn, would not be the heir. These are the years of life of Ishmael, 137 years. So he lives a long time, which is a sign of his blessing. He breathed his last and he died, was gathered his people. And they settled from Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt, as one goes towards Assyria. And he settled in defiance against all of his relatives. Ishmael is also blessed because of the relationship to Abraham. Ishmael was always a hot-blooded man given to bellicosity. The angel told Hagar that it would be so. Hagar's mother is also known for it, even when Ishmael was a child. Genesis 16, "Moreover, the angel of the Lord said to her," that's Hagar, "I will greatly multiply your descendants so that they will be too many to count. The angel of the Lord said to her further, behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son, and you shall name his name Ishmael, because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. And he's a wild donkey of a man, and his hand shall be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him, and he will live east of all his brothers." So Ishmael's nature was to be bellicose, but not with Isaac. Ishmael was problematic in terms of all of his neighbors, everybody lived with. He was feisty, he was warlike in his nature, and it was prophesied by God to Hagar that that would be the case at the beginning.
And what is bellicose?
Warlike, always ready to fight. Chip on his shoulder, scrappy. You know, he was always trying to kill people around him. So, kind of like if you look today, you see what's going on. He was a follower of ISIS, that kind of thing.
When it says he settled in defiance of all his relatives, does that mean that he settled too close to Isaac?
No. It means that there was a lot of warfare going on among them. That there was always something going on. He wasn't a peace-loving man, nor were his descendants peace-loving among themselves. In that sense, he was kind of like his mother.
So do his descendants, Muslims...
His descendants are Arabs. Some of whom are Muslims. Some of whom are Christians.
Well, do the people that came from him think that he was cheated out of being
Absolutely.
The firstborn?
Absolutely. Well, the Muslim story is that the real choice of Abraham was Ishmael, and that the Jews rewrote the record to show that it's Isaac. And they honor Abraham very highly, but they think that Isaac and his followers stole the story, as it were. That is their teaching. Remember that Muslims are very high on Jesus, Mary, and the apostles. And they're very high on much of Christianity, and they sort of take delight in the fact that Christianity shows an enmity between them and the Jews. Yep.
If you go to like Indonesia, which is all Muslim,
yeah,
and
yeah,
you talk to the people and they're like, well, how come we don't have the prophecy? And you know how they answer? We're not Arabs.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We, you gotta remember that many of the Muslims in this world are not Arabs. I mean, and much of Islam is non-Arabic.
Right.
And There's a PBS story that comes on from time to time called The Life of Abraham, of Muhammad, called The Life of Muhammad. And it's put on by a bunch of British Muslims who live there in the midst of all of this. But they are, and they're in Britain as well. And they're British Muslims. And they're none of them Arabic. In fact, when you look at them and you see them, they're obviously Caucasians. And their whole story about Islam is that it's a religion of peace and love and care for your brother and neighborliness, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They are, disclaim, or what do you call them? They deny all of this jihad stuff. They say that it's a perversion of what Muhammad wrote and taught. You know, I remember when I was a kid in seminary in Detroit, when I was going to seminary college, studying to be a priest, that Detroit has a huge Muslim population. And it is known for its caring for the people in the street, its soup kitchens, its free schools, and all manner of things. It's very, very peaceful and peaceful-loving people. Obviously, we have doctrinal differences. But the jihadists have stolen or hijacked the religion to make everybody think that all Muslims are like that. They're not. You won't get elected to office saying that, but that's just not the way it is. They are particularly quiet because they don't want to become the target of the jihadists themselves. But they're starting to have to come out because it is the way it is. But I recommend that show to you, The Life of Muhammad, because what you'll see is a whole different portrayal of Islam from the point of view of non-Arab Muslims. And some Arab Muslims too, but mostly non-Arab Muslims.
So, and, could ISIS be compared to the Crusaders?
Yes, ISIS. All right. Well, so when we talk about jihadists, let's remember that one of the great jihadists of our history was Paul the Apostle. He was a jihadist. He went around killing people in order to get them to convert to his God and to punish them for not. So jihadism is a process whereby someone does holy war against another people for the sake of promoting their religion. So it wasn't like the Arabs invented jihadism. But people, ISIS and the people, ISIS or ISIL as they prefer to call themselves, which means that they are the owners of Israel, not just Saudi Arabia and Iraq and all of it. So the Levant, that's what the L stands for, the Levant. So their whole point is that it is the end times and there's a caliphate that's being established that is like the millennial reign. And that it's their job to go out and forcefully establish the caliphate, which will then rule the world out of their Islam. So the reason why you have so many Muslim countries fighting ISIS is because ISIL, they're just as angry with Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and all those people as they are with the West. Okay, so they...
Maybe a little bit more so.
Maybe so. Well, they let's put it this way, they're the low-hanging fruit, we're next, you know.
Right.
You know, it's sort of helpful to know some of this. But as far as Isaac and Ishmael themselves goes, there was never animosity. And if you read the Talmud and the rabbinical writings about Isaac and Ishmael before Ishmael leaves, what you learn is that Isaac sort of looked up to Ishmael as his older brother. He was proud of him, and it was the mothers that had the problem. And we can see even in the scriptures that Abraham was unhappy to have to send his Ishmael off. Ishmael's bellicosity toward Isaac's sin seems to have been brought forward in Ishmael's future generations. The Arabs remained divided for 4,000 years because in the spirit and the nature of Ishmael, they could not get along with each other. It took the intervention of T.E. Lawrence. Anybody know who T.E. Lawrence is?
Lawrence of Arabia.
It took the intervention of T.E. Lawrence to cause the Arab peoples to come together as a people. And prior to that time, there was absolutely no cohesion between all the various tribes. Have you all seen Lawrence of Arabia? It's a wonderful movie. It starts off after the initial wreck of the motorcycle. It starts off with Omar Sharif shooting a guy dead for drinking from his well because he's Hadi Simith instead of, you know, Harith, which is what he is. And it was T.E. Lawrence that brought all those people together for the sake of King Faisal that started Saudi Arabia and all of the cooperation among the Arabs with one another, yeah, at least at some level. So it took the intervention of T.E. Lawrence, the wisdom of King Faisal, and World War I to unite them. Their unity is fragile, intermittent, and volatile throughout the ages. Mohammed tried to unite them through Islam and by the sword when proselytizing failed. They historically try to blame their problems on Israel, but the problems are more inbred. Jacob's traits have certainly come forward in his future generations. As the new creatures in Christ, we have an opportunity to re-engineer our legacy gifts to the generation that follows us. What will we do with that? In other words, our fathers passed down to us their good and bad habits. And if we're not careful, we just pass our bad habits right on, unless we stop and re-engineer our legacy by asking God to change us and cause us to become more Christ-like so that we can then teach our children what we are. And they become different people. One of the best reasons I know to seek sanctification is for the sake of my children. I can seek sanctification for myself so that I might please the Lord more and all kinds of things. But a better reason is so that my children do not become like I was, or like my father was, or his father before him, or my mother or her mother before them, in those areas which are not good. So I guess we'll stop there and do a red and slick next time. Somebody pray us out.